Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Minkin. I am a general pediatrician and proud JOMA member, and today I'm here with Dr. Ralph Strauss. If there are topics you want to hear, if you want to be interviewed, if you know someone you want to hear being interviewed, if you have comments on this or other podcast episodes, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. We want to hear from you. This is the second episode that I'm doing with Dr. Strauss. When I scheduled one with him to talk about allergies, which we did at the beginning of the spring, he told me that he himself had been a cancer patient and is very passionate about the doctor-patient relationship, partly from what he learned from that experience. And I said, well, we're just going to have to meet again. And here we are meeting again. Dr. Strauss is certified by the American Board of Allergy and Immunology. After graduating from Brandeis University, he began his medical career at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, where he received his medical degree in 1986. He did his internship and residency in pediatrics at Schneider Children's Hospital, Long Island Jewish Medical Center. There, he was recognized with the Best Resident Teaching Award in 1989. He followed up his residency with a two-year fellowship in allergy and immunology at the Long Island Jewish Medical Center. He has multiple professional affiliations, including Winthrop University Hospital, North Shore University Hospital, South Nassau Communities Hospital, Long Island Jewish Hospital, and Stony Brook University Hospital, where he is a clinical assistant professor of pediatrics. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Nassau County Medical Society, and the American College and the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. He has authored and co-authored a number of publications for professional journals. He has made several TV appearances as an expert in allergy and has been quoted in media publications such as the New York Times. Welcome, Dr. Strauss. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It is always such a pleasure to talk to you. I'm looking forward to a great conversation.
I am too. And the reason we're doing this is because when we planned our first conversation, I thought it was going to be about allergies, and it was, and you had a whole other category. You had a whole other layer to you that I didn't know about before. And so now we're going to take time to explore that other layer, which is your experience, not just as a physician, but also as a patient. And so I'd like you to start with that story. I've been waiting for this for a long time.
Sure. So, you know, in 2016, something happened to me that made me a better doctor. I was diagnosed with cancer. We're all going to be on the patient side of medicine. We all are. We all have experiences with doctors. But this was a real, you know, eye-opener. I was a really healthy guy. I worked out regularly. You know, my standard joke was, you know, when I get hit by a truck and they do the autopsy, they're going to say, this guy could have lived to be 100. All of a sudden in 2016, I was shaving and my wife noticed, hey, you know, your right leg is thicker than the other. I said, what are you talking about? She took out a measuring tape, measured one thigh, measured the other thigh, and she was absolutely right. I went to an orthopedist that I knew, nice guy. Tech walks in the room, says, you need an x-ray. I said, no, I don't need an MRI. He says, no, we do x-rays first. I said, let me talk to the doctor. So the doctor walks in, takes a look and says, you need an MRI. We kind of knew what that was. To make a long story shorter, it showed that there was a significant softball-sized tumor in my thigh. I went on a journey finding an orthopedic oncology surgeon that I could trust, had surgery, had radiation, saw a bunch of oncologists in terms of, you know, follow-up plans, and three out of three doctors recommended chemotherapy. And I didn't do chemotherapy. I was, one of these doctors, one of these patients who's disagreeable, looked at the literature and said, you know, this isn't breast cancer. This isn't prostate cancer where you have a very large database. You have a very, very small group of patients. This is a 1 in 500,000 tumor.
Wow.
And, you know, most of this was case reports. And, you know, looking at the risk benefit analysis, I wasn't that impressed. You know, as doctors, we think in terms of number needed to treat, and, you know, we all have our own experiences. So I had seen chemotherapy from the doctor side as well. I knew it wasn't just a benign, you know, healing process. And the chance of winding up a little different, you know, chemo brain, that kind of stuff was sticking with me a whole lot more. So, you know, when I went to a major institution, you know, it was all about life expectancy. You know, you do this because you have a better chance of survival. It's like, that wasn't the most important thing to me as a 50-something year old. It was the quality of my life. And I was very comfortable making the decision, I'm going to forego chemo and I just get surveillance. I had, you know, one small metastasis a couple of years later, and I've been living my life and very happy. I wake up every morning, you know, just thrilled to be here. But it did take me on a journey where I started to think a lot more about the doctor-patient relationship. It really is important to listen to the patient's story and listen to their wants and needs, and not necessarily come in and say, okay, these are the guidelines, we're applying them in your case, and it's not necessarily what the patient might want.
Right. Listen to me, I'm the doctor, I know best.
Right. That model doesn't work anymore.
Right. And it shouldn't.
Right.
And it shouldn't. And it's not just you, you know, who actually had done research, right? I find that to be not uncommon, particularly with rare disorders, that the parent or patient, you know, in pediatrics, the parent is not the patient, but comes in with a lot of information, particularly about rare disorders, because they've done their research and they may know more than the doctor about a rare disorder. Remember, I had a patient once with, it was like Tay-Sachs, but it was something else. I think it was Canavan's. And I had never seen a patient, and the mother would come in, and this was many years ago. This was even before there was real, you know, internet availability. And she would come in with a booklet about, I think it was Canavan's, because the doctors didn't know what she knew.
My very first patient with alpha-gal syndrome came in with the New England Journal of Medicine article, made his own diagnosis.
Oh, tell us about that. What is alpha-gal?
Alpha-gal is a very unusual allergic reaction. It's a delayed reaction to mammalian meat. So it's often called midnight anaphylaxis. The patient will wake up in the middle of the night with hives, vomiting, you know, trouble breathing, full-blown anaphylaxis, but it doesn't follow the usual pattern because it's not right after eating the food. And it actually is, you know, in patients who've had beef or pork or something in the hours before, and it can happen 6 to 8 hours later. It's unusual, and the first time you see it, it's like, you know, what the hell's happening here?
Is this the one where they had a bite from a Lone Star tick?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what primes the whole system and causes the allergic reaction. But yeah, it you know, raises the question in this age where we're going to have artificial intelligence, which is going to be better at making a diagnosis and a treatment plan than a physician is. What's the role of the physician?
Right. I think we're asking a little more of AI than it's going to give us any time in the future.
I think things are going to happen very quickly. And I think, you know, again, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it can work alongside physicians. And, you know, it's very difficult to keep up on any one specialty, even if you're in a small field. Things are happening so rapidly, but a computer can look at all the articles, look at all the information, can give you probability and statistics. And then you're going to need a really good clinician to help you sort through this and decide what you want, decide what's important for you in terms of coming up with a treatment plan.
Right. But it boils down to, you still need the clinician-patient relationship. I'm calling a clinician, okay? I'm not going to just say doctor. I don't want to exclude all the other types of clinicians we have out there.
I think that's my point. I think for young clinicians who are going through training right now, you're overwhelmed by how much information you have to learn. But I'm thinking in the next decade or so, that's not going to be as important as honing your interpersonal skills and actually, you know, listening, forming an empathetic therapeutic relationship with a person. That's what people want.
Right. I'm going to link this to the talk I did with Dr. Danielle Ofri, which is all about the patient doctor or clinician relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yep. She was very astute. It was a great, insightful talk.
Thank you. Thank you. We're never going to not need that human relationship. That's always going to be so important. But I feel like we're fighting against so many factors to maintain that relationship. Right? Yeah, especially after COVID. I mean, I think that, you know, I like the line that you said, the science behind medical recommendations and treatments is stronger than ever, but mistrust is greater. I want to talk a little bit about why we have mistrust and how we could rebuild trust.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction, not only from the patient end, but also the clinician end. Mm-hmm. A lot of us feel like we're just overwhelmed with having to see a lot of patients, and we've become employees and data entry clerks. We're just sitting there typing away in our computer, trying to get all the information in there so we can bill properly and get the insurance information down and make sure we have all the terms in there so we don't get sued for malpractice. And from a patient perspective, you know, they're waiting a long time in the waiting room. They're getting just a few minutes with the clinician, and they're spending a lot of time on the computer. It's like, hello, I'm here. So I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction from that end of it. But also, there's never been more information out there that's so readily accessible. I mean, there's always been misinformation. That's not new at all. But it's just so easy to get it out there and get it available on the internet. And it's hard to know who do you really trust as a resource. When somebody publishes something, is it correct?
Right. And unfortunately, you know, COVID just amplified that distrust because we heard a lot of mixed messaging. We heard a lot of things that weren't true from organizations that many of us trusted prior. Right. And so you look for somebody that you can trust. You can't know everything, right? So you look for someone that you can trust. And what if you end up trusting someone who's charismatic but not telling you the truth?
Exactly. People are looking for simple answers and simple solutions. And for complicated problems, that's not really a thing. And it's important to realize that, you know, when I think Dr. Offit in your interview or one of the others pointed out that anybody who said anything about COVID eventually said something that was incorrect, and it wasn't necessarily intentional. It's because things were happening so rapidly and information was evolving so quickly that you're bound to get stuff wrong. I look at the analogy of sports. You know, pick any sport you like. It's very different now than when you were watching it when you were a kid. If you're a football fan, you know, when I was a kid, it was all about the running back. Now it's all about the quarterback. In basketball, it's the three-point play. You know, in baseball, it's, you know, pitchers used to pitch nine innings. Now, if they go six, that's a lot. So things have changed. The game has changed. And that has been true for medicine also. And during COVID, things were happening just so quickly and so rapidly. I don't know that people were intentionally giving misinformation when we're talking about medical authorities, but it's just people didn't have the right answers necessarily.
Right, and we're not going to go into politics except to note that politics got intertwined, very unfortunately. And so that there is an intentionality, right, sometimes. And so then who do you trust? I don't even think it's a matter of people looking for simple answers, because I find a lot of people who get involved with misinformation are looking for complex. They really want to delve deep, mm-hmm. and they feel they're being patronized, right? Just trust the science, right? Follow the science, right? Remember when they said not to wear masks? And they're, guys, like, you know, just stop buying those masks. And the message kept changing, but it was a very, you know, often a patronizing message, right? So I don't think that it's a matter of people looking for something simple. People are looking to make sense. They may find a very complex explanation of it. But the question is who do they trust and why do they trust that person?
Right. And, you know, it depends on what you're looking for. You know, I think a lot of younger patients are looking for a transactional relationship. I've got a sore throat. I've got a backache. Let me just go to urgent care and get a quick fix here. And they see medical personnel as interchangeable, mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, the old model where you forged a relationship with somebody, right. And you had a trusting relationship. That's the doctor I want to go to. And I think a lot of us still have that. And I think a lot of patients are still looking for that.
Right. That's why we're not using the word provider. I just want to mention here. That kills us. That just crushes our souls.
I absolutely detest the word provider. Yeah. Or customer service when it comes to patient right. care. Okay. It's really a higher level of commitment. When you're doing customer service, whatever the customer says is right. When you're the clinician, you're really looking forward to that. You're looking to do what's in their best interests and to convince them of the right treatment plan.
Right. So then we're back to the doctor knows best model. It sounds like you're kind of pushing for the doctor knows best model. I don't like the term provider because I'm the doctor and I know best. I know you don't mean that, but I want to go back into that.
So, you know, there are things that are that, you know, based on the evidence that we have currently, there is a right or wrong answer. Okay. And I love to go back to what we do as a pediatric organization is vaccinations. I think Dr. Ofri or plenty of people point out that if you lived in the early 1900s, you all knew people that died of pediatric infectious diseases that we've only heard of, you know, measles, rubella, and rubella didn't kill kids, but diphtheria killed a lot of kids. These are diseases that we don't see anymore. And that's, you know, one of the greatest miracles that we've had in the modern age. But it really shouldn't be something that is controversial in these days and ages. This is what is structurally appropriate. When you're talking about another type of healthcare problem where you don't have a direct answer, then it's a risk-benefit analysis. You know, we think that this might be the best approach for you, but this is the downside. This is the side effect. As an allergist, I see a lot of bad outcomes with medications. I see all the, when people prescribe antibiotics for something as simple as an ear infection, sometimes it ends up with a horrific rash. And a lot of times ear infections will get better on their own. So you can say, hey, I think your kid has an ear infection. You're not that sick. There's an 80% chance that this will resolve spontaneously. If it doesn't get better, maybe then we'll prescribe an antibiotic. But a lot of parents don't want to hear that. Isn't that what you're getting on your side?
So yes and no. I mean, if you're doing the collaborative model, right, then you'd have your speech and then they may say, but I need my kid back in daycare. I can't wait 24 hours. I'll take that smaller chance of an allergic reaction for the quicker fix of the antibiotics. And that's not necessarily wrong.
Not at all. But that's a discussion.
Right. Right. So that I do agree with that. And, you know, that's where that collaborative model comes in. And back to vaccines, I just want to make a point about vaccines because I do have these kind of conversations all the time. Vaccines is different because, first of all, we're a victim of our own success, right? Because we're not seeing these illnesses because the vaccines work so well.
So, again, the risk-benefit analysis changes when you're talking about, let's say, an older individual or somebody who's got asthma. Versus a young, healthy person who, may not see that as more of a significant risk. When you're talking about a highly contagious disease like measles, that affects the population in general. And I look at that like traffic control. One person who decides to roll through a stop sign or not obey speed limits, not a big problem. If everybody does it, we got a big problem and we're going to have a lot more people dying as a result. So I put that in a different category. Let's take the HPV vaccine. If you have a religious population, how do you convince someone to get it? What's that conversation like?
I think what I was going to also talk about with vaccines is similar to antibiotics, you may offer your best information and the parent or patient may say, I don't want it.
That's okay.
I don't want it. And I think that's where, the collaborative care comes in. It's not our job to sell something to you or try to get you to, to do what we think is best. It's our job to offer the information as clearly as we can.
That's exactly right.
Right.
However, sometimes the information is so clear, you don't necessarily want to step back. So, I have this conversation with patients about smoking cessation, for instance. Sometimes patients don't want to hear it. They really are. There's a lot of reasons why they do unhealthy behaviors. But it's a conversation I'm going to come back to at other times when I think they're ready for it. And I approach that in a totally different manner. I don't say, hey, it's time to quit smoking. I say, hey, would you be willing to put a patch on? Would you be willing to try Chantix or something like that to kind of move the needle towards doing this? And I'm not going to give up on it because I think you have a much better chance of better quality of life and longer life if you quit smoking. And that's totally patient-centered.
Right. That's a whole different conversation also, because that's an addictive substance, right? So you may not be able to see why that's making your asthma worse.
There are lots of reasons why people do things that are unhealthy for them. And that really involves getting to know someone and getting to know where they're really at. I see this as analogous to all the time. People will come to me for reasons that are not necessarily allergic in nature. You know, if you bring in a child who has attention deficit disorder or autism, or you have an older person who's got chronic migraine headaches and they want to know if they have allergies, I could say, look, this is not an allergic condition. You belong with another doctor. So long, have a nice day. But I really haven't helped them at all.
Right.
So going back to the lady with the migraines, we'll go over, okay, you've seen the neurologist, you've seen the acupuncturist. What foods do you find that trigger your migraine? They may not be on an IgE-mediated basis. Allergy testing will not help you. And it's important to understand that. But there may be some foods that you can identify that you may want to experiment with taking out of your diet and making you feel better. And then going into a little bit more about what are you doing to take care of yourself? Okay, you've got a mother of four kids, you know, two teenagers, one kid is on the spectrum. What are you doing to take care of yourself? Where do you get some me time in there? Where do you get some relaxation time in there? All those things are totally unrelated to allergy, but it makes for a much more satisfying visit on the patient end and on the doctor end.
Now, that's amazing that you do that, though, because I think a lot of specialists, you know, you go see them and they tell you whether you have something within their specialty or not. And that's amazing that you could look at it more holistically.
I think you really, you know, I learned that if you're going to be a specialist, you first have to practice in general medicine first.
Right.
And you don't want to miss anything. So again, I'm an allergist. The biggest problem a patient coming to see me may have may be totally unrelated. If, you know, we're taking their blood pressure and we find it's excessively high, that's something that needs to be addressed and may be more important than a stuffy runny nose.
Right. But I'm also fascinated by somebody coming to you, they've heard that allergies can cause migraines or whatever it is. And instead of just getting stuck on the IgE mediator that you can see, you're also looking at effects that you may not be able to see instead of saying they don't exist. I'm finding that very interesting because I think one of the problems we're facing in medicine today is illness, right? They're suffering. They're not necessarily things we can measure, right? Say like chronic fatigue, long COVID, a lot of illness.
Exactly. Right? We haven't come up with a marker yet. We haven't come up with anything identifiable. And if you do not address them, they will turn to alternative practitioners who give you simple solutions. So in the field of allergy, you know, people will do, you know, a lot of, not good medicine. They'll look for IgG mediated antibodies, which we all have, which are not related to allergy and have not been shown to have a clinical effect. They'll look for sensitivity testing that can be done through chiropractic manipulation. But people love to get answers. Avoid these foods and you're going to feel better. And there is a very large placebo effect, and I don't argue with success.
Right.
But you need to have a conversation about what you can realistically expect and what things can do. Don't do unnecessary tests. Don't order unnecessary treatments. Spend a little time talking to the patient. Unfortunately, our model is that we don't get paid for that.
Right.
I get more money for testing somebody than for talking to them.
Right. Do you have people that come to you and they're doing alternative allergy treatments?
Of course.
As they come see you? So how do you handle that?
Again, my model is I don't argue with success. It's a different line of treatment. If you have a good relationship with that person and it's not harmful, I don't object to it, but this is what I can offer and this is what I think will help you.
Right, because I don't think we should be undermining the placebo effect. You know, it's like mocked as placebo, meaning it doesn't really work, it's all in your head, but feeling better is the bottom line, who cares?
I think we have to approach this with a great deal of humility.
Yeah.
There are unfortunately unscrupulous people out there who just want to, take people's money.
Right.
But that's true on the conventional medicine side,
right,
as well. But, as an allergist, we were giving allergy shots for decades before we discovered IG and we found out how it worked. So we just have to realize that, things like acupuncture in Eastern medicine, we're just finding out now clinical studies about how it actually may be effective.
Right. But, we do have this ability to heal ourselves, right? I mean, when we're talking about placebo, when we're talking about mind body, we're talking about healing that's coming from within. And that's a real thing.
One of my favorite quotes is from Voltaire. the job of the physician is to amuse the patient while nature heals them.
And that's the problem with all this information is we can become so arrogant that we have answers.
But, you know, again, I think we have to, you know, look at our data and talk to people. So if people are coming to us, you know, for instance, for back pain, we can say, look, back pain gets better in 6 to 8 weeks, no matter what you do. If we're not dealing with neurologic deficits, this is not the time necessarily to do an MRI or to, you know, prescribe narcotics, which may have addictive potential. You know, let's go with, you know, something a little less invasive and just kind of give it time and keep moving and it'll get better. And then if you don't, then we can look at other things.
Right. I find though that there are people have preferences, you know, one of my patients or parents have preferences on the end, on the spectrum from natural to more interventional. I don't know if you're seeing that. And they come in with that pre-existing preference.
That's where communication is important.
Right.
So, you know, history is really his or her story or their story. So you have to take the time to listen. If you've been doing this for a while, you know what the diagnosis and treatment plan is within two sentences. And, you know, study after study shows that doctors usually interrupt the patient within seconds.
Right.
But you lose something when you do that. So you actually have to let them tell their story and you can hear their concerns. And you have to do that without the computer in front of you, which is a real trick.
You know, what's really important is to find out why they're there, you know, what their main goal is, because it's not necessarily the first words out of their mouth.
Right. And you have to know what they're worried about, what they're concerned about.
Right.
You know, I see patients with hives. They worry if they're going to wake up in the middle of the night with throat closing, full-blown anaphylaxis.
Right.
Not going to happen. You know, sometimes people will come in, you know, an older person will come in with chronic hives. And they'll start relating the story. I ate this food and then I broke out in hives. And then I ate that food and then I broke out in hives. And after listening to the story, it's like, okay, you've got a rash and we don't know why. You have to kind of cull it down, but you have to tell them why it's not likely to be a food allergy and why going down that path, they may be expecting extensive food allergy testing, is not going to be helpful for them.
Right. So I think we've talked a lot about what clinicians can do to help rebuild trust and have that relationship. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what you could do as a patient. And I just want to point back out again, what you said at the very beginning is the doctors tried to tell you what they thought you should do, the chemotherapy, and you came back and said no.
Well, you know, again, the assumption was that I'd want the best chances of living a long life. That wasn't really what was the most interest for me. It's the quality of life that really counted. So I think from the patient side, you need to tell your story, but be succinct. Realize that doctors are kind of pressed for time. When it's important, it's good to bring somebody with you. You know, so I've been in medicine for many years. I had actually done oncology research in medical school. But when the doctor said, you have cancer, this was like Charlie Brown going, wah, 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 wah. I didn't hear anything else after that. Fortunately, I brought my wife with me who took notes, asked good questions. And it's like, okay, then I could begin to digest the situation and understand it better. When it's important, it's not a bad idea to get a second opinion. And it's important to build a relationship with that physician, feel like you have a therapeutic partnership. If you don't have that, you know, you may have to move on.
Right. No, it really is, because trust has to be earned.
Right.
And trust.
I use the term salesmanship in the best possible sense. It's patient-centered. It's giving them what they need, hearing them what they need, and then trying to convince them of it. And if they don't do it, you don't give up on them. You kind of come back to it and say, you know, I really think you're going to be better off with that flu vaccine this year, because you have COPD, you have, you know, heart disease. And if you get the flu, it could be pretty nasty for you.
Right, but from the patient's perspective, they might have to do salesmanship on why they want something different from what you are absolutely sure is right for them.
Well, you know, doctors are trained to think in data, okay? We look at, okay, if you treat this population the same way, most of the patients are going to have better outcomes that way. Patients think in stories. So if Uncle Louie was in great health until he was 90 years old, went to his doctor, got a flu shot, and the next week he was dead, it's like that story is going to be embedded in their head. If he hadn't gotten the flu shot, he'd still be alive today.
Right. I wasn't on the flu shot analogy.
There
are things that are really so objectively clear. And then there are things where, you know, you gave your own story where the doctor might be wrong because the best outcome that the patient values is not the best outcome that the physician values.
Right. Exactly. But, you know, again, patients and doctors are colored by their experiences as well. So if you hear stories about people having bad outcomes with certain treatments or certain things are embedded in your mind as a physician, you remember that really bad case that you had 20 years ago, that's going to color your experiences and it may not be objective in terms of the data.
Also, I think this is helpful. Not everybody would think this is helpful, but I think it would be helpful when a parent or a patient is having a bad experience, something the physician said, for example, clinician said, for example, bothered them, is to say it, right? I mean, it's kind of a relationship skill. Something bothers you, you say something about that. I don't think it happens often enough. I think people get upset and go and talk about it. Maybe they write bad reviews, but they don't actually tell the clinician. I'm going a different route now. This wasn't on our list.
No.
I'm just thinking about it. It happened to me once. A parent said to me something and I'm like, you know, I wasn't my best that day. And I appreciated so much that this parent reached out to me. It was such incredible kindness in a way for her to reach out to me rather than write a bad review or, you know, speak to somebody above me.
I think it really is important to have that relationship. Doctors are people. Right. Clinicians are people. And I always think of empathy as a battery that needs to be recharged. And you have to know where you are. I mean, are you tired? Is it the end of the day? Are you stressed out by what's going on in your personal life? And yes, if you say something unkind or is not received well, that's going to really color that patient's experience. That's going to stick in their mind. They're going to remember it. And it's unfortunate, but we've all had that experience. We've all had things that we said or came out in a way that we didn't want to say it.
Right. Or just, you know, didn't read the room right. Right.
Right.
And that can happen. So I'm just putting out a plea for the relationship that if you're the patient, you can say something.
If you have trust in the bank, it goes a long way. So if you've developed a relationship right. over time, that really goes a long way. If this is your first visit and you're saying something stupid, it may not go.
But you can leave, you know, information at the front desk and say, this is what happened. This is feedback. I think feedback is really important.
Absolutely. I just want to put in a plug for something we did in Allied Physicians Group, which was the Empathy Project. Every office watched a short video produced by NYU Langone. Dr. Lapook was involved with that on what it's like to be a patient. And this was, you know, the experience of a Black woman coming to a physician who was trying to be considerate, but didn't understand what it was like to come to a physician from that perspective. And I think it really brought up a whole discussion. I got to put in a plug for Mary Lou Marotta and Andrea Tobias, because they were the leaders of this. They led a very fruitful discussion where people brought out, what's it like to bring an autistic child to a physician's office? What's it like to be in an office where you don't speak the same language, where you have different socioeconomic backgrounds? We all come to it, you know, from our own field of you know, our own group, our own society. It's important to broaden your perspective. You know, where is this patient coming from? What is their experience at a physician's office? And how do you communicate effectively with them? We all learn to use jargon. Okay, we've learned to speak a different language, and we don't necessarily speak in simple terms. We all do it. We all use abbreviations. We all use terms that we think people understand, but not necessarily so.
Right. Is there a link to that I can share?
There is. It's the Empathy Project, and it's the Elephant in the Waiting Room. It's really a great short video. I think every clinician should watch it. We stopped the video at certain points and discussed it. But it, you know, videos and things like that really bring out your humanity.
Right.
So I think, you know, whatever you like to do, whether you like to read books about different cultures, go to plays, go to museums, it really is important to heighten those observation skills and think about things from the perspective of people who don't necessarily look like you or think like you.
Right. And, you know, we were talking about how we would like the parent patient to advocate for themselves, but these are often people who can't.
Right.
Right.
You know, people come in from different avenues. Some people come in, look, doc, tell me what to do. I'll do it. Right. Other people want to be your partner.
Right.
And then there's the third type of patient who comes in with reams of stuff that they discovered on the internet. These are the tests I want, and I want you to do it. And if you don't, I'm going elsewhere.
Right. That's a whole spectrum of collaboration, right?
It is. It is. You work for me, doc.
Oh, gosh. Where do we go with that one?
You've had that attitude, I'm sure.
You know, I think it's really important to be able to build that relationship. Again, it may not be as collaborative as someone who doesn't want to be part of that, right? They just want you to tell them what to do. You can respect that. But I don't think the opposite end will work, right?
I think you need to take a step back and think about where this person is coming from, okay? Very often when people are angry, when they're bitter, they've had life experiences that have made them that way. Mm-hmm. So you have to think, okay, what is this person really angry about? And how can I make things better for them? And if you can, that's great. And if you can't, sometimes you have to agree to part company, either from the clinician side or from the patient side. It's like, this is not going to work.
Right. No, that's true. I mean, I certainly have patients that come in asking for something, and I can work with them and explain why that particular thing is not something I think is medically indicated. And there are some that you can't agree to disagree. You know, you can't be part of their care if you don't agree with the care at all.
Right. Right. So I'll give you an example from my world. You know, sometimes we see kids with multiple food allergies, and parents are really concerned about keeping their very young child safe. So they want a note for, you know, not only wiping down tables or having to eat in the classroom, they want the kid to have lunch separately, which is not in their best interests. You're losing out on the social interaction. So I point out to them, you know, we're going to take a little bit of a risk here that they might be exposed to their food allergen, but it's really important for them to have lunch with their peers. There's so much that happens during lunchtime that's so important for their development. And we have to put those risks in perspective. Life is not about taking zero risk.
Right. And I'm actually seeing a lot of that. There's a lot of parental anxiety, right? And in a way, the media kind of makes that worse, right? By exaggerating with their headlines, because fear sells.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's hard. It adds to our workload, right? I'm finding every patient interaction just takes longer.
It does, but you have to take the time to do it. And how do you make a short interaction effective? For me, it's being totally present. Right. So taking the time to listen attentively. I try not to interrupt unless I'm getting lost in terms of the story. And then I ask, you know, the questions that I want to ask that's going to hone down the story. And then communication is not about getting out as much information as you can or making a speech. You have to remember that people don't retain that much information.
Right. So, oh, I'm so glad you said that.
Alan Alda wrote a great book. If I understood you, would I have this look on my face?
Alan Alda. Oh yes, my gosh.
He started the Alan Alda Center for Communication and Science in Stony Brook. But he makes some really excellent points that you need to explain things simply. You know, most people understand things at the level of a sixth grade education. If you use a lot of jargon, a lot of terms, they're losing it. And people retain 3 points. So if you're making a whole bunch of points, a lot of it is just going out the window. Think of the 3 most important things you want to bring up. Say them again, have the patient respond to you in terms of, okay, this is what I understand. This is what I take out of this visit. And then you move on to the next visit. So if you're going to talk for 45 minutes, which some, you know, clinicians do, they like to talk, they're not necessarily going to retain it. It's not necessarily going to be a better visit. I think you can be short and efficient. And I think, you know, Dr. Ofi was pointing out, you know, what's important to the patient? You have to address that concern. And what do you think is the most pressing problem for that patient? And that's something you need to address as well.
Right. And we're supposed to do reteaching in our short visits, right? Right, to make sure they understand that you can't just give a whole therapy, you know, set of things and assume they understood you the first time.
And primary care is so much more difficult because there's so many things that you have to hit on,
yeah.
you know, as opposed to, you know, a specialty, they're coming in usually with one focus problem. In my field, sometimes it's three or four. Sometimes it's asthma, allergic rhinitis, atopic right. dermatitis, you know, food allergies, you know, people have multiple problems, but you can't do it all in one visit. So you have to think, okay, what is the most important thing for them right now?
Right, I think it's important for patients to understand that you may have to come back because we can only do so much. You can only retain so much, but we can also only address so much properly.
Right.
Give the time it deserves.
And follow-up is so important.
Yeah. It's true, because you can't expect that the first thing you try will necessarily work.
Right. If somebody is sick and you give them a call just to see how they're doing a few days later, that goes so much further in setting up the relationship. I'll tell you a quick story. A number of years ago, I had a longstanding patient and a report came across my desk from a urologist that he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. So I pick up the phone and I give him a call. And, you know, it's, oh, Dr. Strauss, I'm really sorry. I haven't been in the office. I've been so busy. It's like, wait, I'm not calling about that. I'm calling to see how you're doing. I just heard you had cancer. And he was speechless. He's like, wow. It's like, I sent that report to 8 or 9 doctors. You're the only one who actually called me to see how I was doing. That's like, not that I was, you know, feeling so great about myself, but like, what's wrong with our humanity that we have so many doctors who can see a patient and not actually care that this person was diagnosed with cancer? That was before I was diagnosed myself, of course, but it's just kind of reaching out and realizing that you have a relationship with these people.
That's really sad. I'm really sad about that story.
Yeah, and you know, there's another quote from Peabody. He said, you know, the key to taking care of patients is to actually care for them.
Right, right. It's hard because I don't think people realize how much time we are busy with computer work, with paperwork, right, with other phone calls, with prior authorizations for insurance denials, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, you know, it can crush the life out of you as a human being.
Right. There's such a huge problem with burnout among clinicians. And this is, you know, talked about all the time. And there's a lot of things structurally that need to be changed in medicine. But one of the cures for that I talk about is you have to improve your empathy. You have to recharge that battery. You have to go out and take care of yourself, do things that are important to you. Sometimes that means cutting down on work. And sometimes that means just spending some time getting to know your patients.
Okay, I'm going to say something here. It's not just burnout, it's moral injury. And the reason that is being rebranded as moral injury is because it puts the pressure on us as the clinicians that it's our fault that we're burning out, as opposed to everything that we've gone through, you know, that we're fighting against. So there really needs to be structural changes as well. Mm-hmm. And I think patients have to understand what we're up against. I think that's also important.
Yeah, I don't think
empathy. Empathy goes both ways in a relationship.
I don't think it's unique in medicine. I think there's a lot of fields where people are just feeling that moral injury. They don't feel a job satisfaction anymore. They feel like they're cogs in a wheel where they need to just churn out work. So I think we have to realize what other people do as a living as well.
Right.
And that increases the anxiety and the depression and all the mental health burdens in our society. But you know, if there's any hope for this, you know, there's a book by Eric Topol called Deep Medicine, mm-hmm. where he thinks artificial intelligence will actually improve our lots because it'll take the computer out of the office. You know, the computer will be listening in, we'll be culling that information, we'll be telling people, okay, this is what you're at risk for, these are your treatment options. And then we can actually just work on the discussion with the patient about what's important to you, what are we going to do on this healthcare journey to make your life better?
Right. I mean, we have the tools and the tools are, you know, have a lot of potential and are getting better. The question is, what are we doing with them, you know, and the larger framework of medicine?
Right. These are questions I'd like your younger listeners to think about.
Right.
You know, what's medicine going to be like during their careers? It's not going to look anything like what it was for ours. How can we use the tools of artificial intelligence to help us get better? What can we do in the examination room to lean in and get to know people better and not get bogged down into all the other crap that goes on?
Yeah, but we have to fight for the soul of medicine, because the soul of medicine is the patient-clinician relationship. That's the right. bottom line, and we can't let that go. And we have to build that trust. We have to earn that trust. And we have to remember that relationship is the essence, and nothing should get in the way. It doesn't matter how much you know, right? Like I said, it matters how much you care.
Exactly. Maya Angelou.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. It really boils down to that. It's about the relationship, and it's about caring for other people. And that's right. why we all went into this. And it really is very, you know, when you actually lean into a visit and you feel like you've actually helped somebody, there's no better feeling in the world.
Right. It's so true.
And you can tell when you've made that connection on both ends. You can tell when the patient really got what you said, and when you feel that, you know, they really understood where you're coming from.
Right. There's nothing like it. You're absolutely right.
And that's why we do this.
Right. Right. And that's the healing for the moral injury. It really is.
Right. The healing is the interpersonal relationship.
Right.
So bottom line is, we need to, you know, as younger doctors, you spend so much time learning all the facts and all the stuff about medicine. You really have to spend some time thinking about communication, thinking about not just cultural competence, but just understanding people. And then you really have to think about how you're going to communicate what's best for them and how you can help them on their journey towards better health.
Right, and go into it with an attitude of, I have so much to learn from you, the patient, right? You'll learn so much if you listen.
Absolutely.
So I want to thank you so much for doing this with me.
This was fun.
Yeah, you are an amazing, amazing physician, human being. And I really appreciate your spending time with me talking about this today.
I think we share that. I think it's, you know, it's a mutual admiration, but it's great. And I love talking about it. It's really invigorating.
It's important. It really is. So I want to thank you so much. I want to wish you a good Shabbos.
Same to you.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.